Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet. Not by chance.
Jeff Harvey is with us, and we are going to talk about detoxification through nutrition. He's a technologist and a healing arts practitioner working with emerging technologies in the healing field. He specializes in chronic disease reversal and accelerated deep tissue wound healing. He is a board-certified Corum nutrition consultant. And let's say, Jeff Harvey, welcome to the show.
Nice to speak with you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's start from scratch. Let's lay a base and get a definition so we can work from there. Jeff, what is Quorum? What is a Quorum nutrition consultant?
Think of it as an agreement between tissues and systems in the body to work together when they have what they need to do their job.
Okay, so in essence, what we're saying here is the body has a certain way to function, works through nutrition, which are chemicals, and so on and so forth. When there is a disconnect, there's a problem with whatever it is that you have to move forward with what we need to be able to have a healthy existence. So what you're saying is you connect the disconnected, if I'm hearing you right.
Correct. Well, you know, if you look at it 50, 60 years ago, we didn't have diabetes in children in high school and grade school. We didn't have the quantity and quality of cancers we have today. So we know we're dealing with a whole lot more toxin load than we ever did before.
But where does the toxin load come from? Does it come through food? Does it come through the air? What is it that causes this increase of toxin load?
All right. In short, you've got millions of pounds of toxins being released into the atmosphere every year. All you got to do is look at the reports from the CDC and other locations. If you look at the food supplies, most of these processed foods have extreme levels of irritants and things that are absolutely bad for the body in them. People have been taught for many years, you know, eat your polyunsaturated fats from seed oils and fish oils and you'll do well. It turns out the truth behind that is they cause a tremendous amount of inflammation and estrogen ramp up in the body, which creates inflammation in your cells, and it's a great way to get diabetes.
But isn't inflammation really one of the primary causes of most of what goes on with it, i.e. heart problems and so on and so forth?
Exactly. And a lot of the major researchers will tell you that inflammation is the major underlying cause of a lot of the disease processes out there, including cancer. And I get plenty of folks that have cancer and thyroid issues and diabetes. And we've got a pretty good success rate because we use a very specific method and an order in which we detox the body. And it's been many years in the making, and it keeps getting refined.
Okay, so effectively, we're talking about, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, we're talking about taking out of the body those things that cause the disease, the illnesses, and all of those problems that cause us to be sick and quote-unquote die. Now, when we deal with detoxification, how do we do that? What's the process to go through to get to that point of clearing and cleansing?
All right, let's talk about the easy way. If you give the body the nutrients it's missing and you give them in sufficient quantities, the body will immediately begin to detox itself, and it starts excreting out through the urine and the feces all of the heavy metal toxins, the dead bacteria and cell structures that have died, and a lot of these viral forms that are in the body. And then, of course, there's the nasty one that really stumps everybody, and that's mold. And so that's the reason why when we do detox for someone, we actually do it in a specific order so we get them all cleaned out. And so the big issue is give the body what it needs to do its job, and it will do its job. Unless, of course, you know, you had some mechanical defect, like you were in a car accident and lost a particular organ.
Now, by the way, how do we find out what's in the body? You know, the standard ways, you know, with the blood tests and the rest of it. But when you talk about quantum, it sounds like it's something that steps above and beyond the norm of what most people have been experienced.
It is. In our detox kit that we use on my website, which is jeftech.net, we use some very specific nutrients that have been quorum fermented, which means they'll actually ferment the nutrients into multiple layers over many weeks so that they're about 10 times more powerful than you would get if you went to a health food store and bought, a vitamin mix. And the reason why we do that is because in today's day and age, you want to get the nutrients into the system without having to challenge the liver and make it break them all down and use them again.
Well, let me make sure I heard that, Jeff. Let me hold you up.
They're all organic, and they do a great job of getting into the system fast.
Okay, let me hold you up just to make sure that I've got that. Because when we're talking about, let me make sure I heard you right. Let's say I take, quote, unquote, vitamin C. Now, based on the value of that C, the strength of the C, it's going to get into my system, do the job that it's going to do. But what you're saying, I can take that same C, it layers with C and layers with another C, so to speak, and by the time it really gets into my system, it's maybe 4, 5, 10 times the strength of the normal vitamin C and have the effect on me.
Yes, except for the difference is it's not just another layer of C. C alone takes hundreds of other compounds to work effectively, and when you buy vitamin C in a store, you're getting an isolate. You're probably getting ascorbic acid, which has been isolated from the other hundreds of compounds that it needs to work properly. We put them all together in so they get all the compounds that make it work and do what it's supposed to do instead of getting a neutered version of vitamin C.
Now, by the way, I got that loud and clear, but is this a one shoe fits all? And the reason I'm saying that is, let's say if I got a blood test and I was low in iron, so they're going to give me B12, and B12, let's say, is going to get into the blood system and boost my iron. But what if, and I'm going to have to make something up because I'm not sure the dynamic of this, but what if not only does it take the B12, but it takes something like calcium or something else that will cause that B12 to go into the blood system as opposed to going into the skin and not doing any good for me. So everybody seems to have a little bit of a different dynamic in the way they're anatomically structured. So do you, when somebody does this, is it one shot of whatever it is that's going to work for everybody, or is it a degree for each person?
All right, absolutely not. Here's how it really works. When we do a formulation, the formulation will have everything that's needed because each vitamin has maybe a couple other vitamins that are tied to it that they're called precursors that they need to work properly. They might need a couple of minerals and then a couple of maybe bioflavonoids and some phenols. Well, what we do is when we formulate these things, and these are formulated by top scientists that know what they're doing, and they basically will formulate them so that you can take any human body and you will give them everything they need to upregulate the particular systems that will help the body detox out what it's supposed to be doing naturally, but it's stuck. There's a sphincter of Oddi and an ampulla of Vater. These are little channels down in the intestinal areas, and what they do is they excrete toxins through them. But if they're clamped down tight by the muscles around them, then all the toxins back up. So we give all the nutrients for all the surrounding nerves, all the surrounding organs and tissue to make them have what they need so that it doesn't matter if you're a little low on D3 and perhaps K or whatever, you're going to get them all. And the nutrients that you're not using, many of those will get, if you have too much or an excess, you just simply excrete those in the urine or they get stored and wait until they need it. And that's the reason why we do it the way we do it.
Now, how did you come across this? What was it that triggered you to take a look at health in and of itself and the way people treated themselves to become healthy? Where was it for you that you realized that there was something missing and this was the big one, and how'd you find it?
In 2003, I was dying. I had about 2 weeks left to live. I had cancer, and most of my systems were shutting down. And it was mainly because I was exposed to radiation in the military, and I had been eating terribly, like the average American does, for many years. And when you do that and don't feed the right nutrients in, you're going to die. And a doc had gotten hold of me that was a naturopath by name of Gary Tunsky, and he gave me whole food juicing, and he did a little chelation work with me, and he showed me how to detox my body. And about 8 months later, I was running again. It took a year and a half to learn to walk again properly, but I came back. So I decided it was time to learn this, and I spent many years studying with him, Doc Yannick. I'm now studying Dr. Ray Peet's work, and we're actually coming to the point now where there's very few things that we're not able to help people with.
Well, let me ask you this, and there's got to be some challenges out there. I went through a health challenge 13 years ago. Same. I didn't do the traditional. I went the other way, and I'm here talking to you. But that said, where are the challenges? Why aren't doctors across the country using this? You've got to have a place where they're stopping you.
All right, they're starting to adopt this, but if you look at medical school, they get very, very little nutritional counseling. So they don't understand how these nutrients work, and in many respects, they'll tell you nutrition has nothing to do with your health, when in fact, we all know that it does. But you're going to see, and we already are, many medical doctors now are starting to embrace detox and nutrition because they realize that integrative medicine is the wave of the future. Because when you can take a fourth stage cancer patient and bring them back just with nutrition and detox, that's a pretty powerful argument for being able to help people.
Oh, no question. I was a 3B 13 years ago, and they brought me back, and I was supposed to die in a year and a half with chemotherapy, radiation, whatever, which I took none of it. So what that really says is there's an alternative way, and doctors are starting to get the idea that allopathic medicine, and it's great in certain areas, isn't the be-all, end-all. Yeah. No, got it loud and clear. All right, we're just about out of time. Jeff, let me ask you this. Is there a website we can get more information?
Sure. If you go to www.jeftech.net, there's a lot of information there, and I'm updating it this week, in fact. Or if somebody needs some help or counseling, you can email me at jef@jeftech.net, and, of course, I'll respond. I send out a 10-page health questionnaire that will help us get the background so we know what we're doing with the individual.
Wonderful. Is this expensive?
No, and that's the really interesting part. Just about anyone with a regular job can afford to do this and do it slowly or fast, whichever way they prefer. And we can help them even if they have very low income. There are still things you can do to get your health improving. It'll just take longer.
Wonderful. Hey, Jeff Harvey, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Good night.
Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything
just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Dr. Susan Kolarik with us, PhD. She's an assistant vice president of instructional technology and oversees online curriculum development at St. Leo University. St. Leo is a private, not-for-profit Catholic university located near Tampa and also offers traditional and blended courses. St. Leo offers online courses around the world, particularly to men and women serving in the U.S. military. Susan, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I think online is probably one of the most brilliant ideas that anybody ever came up with. It's got to be a whole lot less expensive than going to a four-year university. And there are people who can't afford it, but they have the ability. They've got the smarts. They got the will. And this is the way they've done it. And let's take it all the way back to the beginning. Where was the online created? What was the first concept idea? How did it get to be a university that it is?
Oh, excellent question. There's been a lot of online training that started in the corporate world, but most of the universities that started about 10 years ago, a little bit longer for some. And we did it in order to reach out to students who weren't located near a particular university, but they wanted to study that particular program. The online revolution started a number of years back so that it gave us the opportunity to present more engaging content online.
Now, by the way, when I say how valid, when somebody has an MBA, an MS, a doctorate from an online university, is it as valid as going to SC, UCLA, one of the major universities?
That's a very good question, and it does depend on the university. Most of them who are in the program want to have at least as good quality as what's in the classroom. But what we're finding as we have more and more classes online is that faculty members online have a greater opportunity to evaluate each individual student's ability much more closely than they could in the classroom. For instance, if you had 50 students sitting in a class, maybe one or two students would answer the questions from the instructor. But in an online class, every student will be answering the question. So that gets to be a real asset for the students because the faculty member can more easily gauge whether you're understanding or struggling with a concept.
No, by the way,
The coursework, it's very similar. It's, in most cases, it's identical to the exact same coursework that we would do on ground.
Okay, well, let me ask this. What is the average degree somebody leaves with in an online university?
It can range from an associate's degree all the way up to doctorates.
Okay. So effectively, go ahead.
Any level of study is available at any university across the country, and that's one of the benefits as well. You get a much wider range of program offerings online.
Okay. So let's say let's say I come in. I decide I want to do this, and I'm probably older than everybody there at the university, and I have no formal education. I have to start from scratch. How would you work with me?
Absolutely. Most students who are online tend to be older. They tend to be working adults. So you're probably not going to be the oldest person in the class. We have people from every age. We had some people graduating this past May who were in their 60s and very happy to be able to go back and get their degree. The first thing we do is take a look at what you're interested in studying, whether you want to go for a complete degree program, or if you're just interested in a couple classes for enrichment. And that'll help plan out your program of study.
Okay, so basically, if somebody wants to do it, now how long does it normally take, let's say, to get a doctorate?
To get a doctorate, you'd probably be assuming that you already have a master's degree, and a doctorate's probably going to be a 5 to 6 year commitment. And that's okay, generally, so, most doctorate programs have some residential component as well.
All right. Now, are we talking about, is this expensive? But what kind of money are we talking about to do this kind of a program?
That's going to vary, and that's definitely something students want to look into, depending on the school that they're looking at. There could be a state university where you're going in-state and you have in-state tuition, or you could be with a private university that in some cases is actually less expensive than some of the other institutions. So that is going to vary a great deal depending on the program that you're interested in as well as the university.
Okay, so effectively, what we're really dealing with is somebody could start online at pretty much any level. You get the idea of quote-unquote cost, time commitment, and so on and so forth. Now, is there any restrictions, any limitations to the kind of courses I can take?
No, it's just going to be limited by the number of programs that you're looking at. So, for instance, if you have a very specialized program that you're interested in, say criminal justice, then not every school is going to offer that program. So you first want to identify the best school for you. Then look at the financial assistance that's available through that school. And then you want to look at the program commitments that they have. And it will vary a great deal. Some programs will have a synchronous component. So you may actually be online 1 hour a week at a particular day and time. Others are completely asynchronous, and you would do the work over, say, the course of a week. There's also a lot of variation in how long a course lasts. Some programs are 8-week classes that are worth 3 credits, so that's an accelerated program, and you're learning a lot more material in a shorter amount of time. So there's a lot of variation that students can look for when they're looking at the programs and find something that fits their lifestyle and their work schedules.
You know, one thing that is very expensive for students, obviously, are textbooks. If it's an online course, do the textbooks come out in ebook fashion?
We always offer ebooks for all courses, and you're going to find that typical across all programs. Sometimes the books will be included as part of the tuition, and sometimes they're purchased separately. Again, that's something to ask the program that you're interested in. A lot of students, even though they're taking a class online, prefer to have a traditional textbook that they can make notes in and mark up, and we always make that option available as well.
Okay, so if there is a class online, how many people are normally in the class? Let's say I join in, I become part of one of the classes. Am I going to be with 50, 100, 300, 1,000 different students during that hour?
That's a great question, because I think administrators originally saw this as an opportunity to put a whole bunch of students in a class and have one faculty member there. And what we found over the years is that the ideal class size is more around 25 to 30 students. So that's definitely a question you should ask if you're interested in a program, is ask them what is the average class size for that program. The smaller the class size, the more attention you'll get from a faculty member when you need it.
You know, a thought struck me as you were talking. How do you take a test? And when I say how do you take a test, yeah.
Sure, there are tests online in some programs, but most universities are actually going toward a project-based assessment. So you'll complete a particular project that has all of the components inside it rather than taking a traditional multiple choice test. Now, you might have some tests that will be quizzes, weekly quizzes, to make sure you're keeping up with the material. And they'll generally be timed, and they'll be randomized questions. So your questions would be different from one of your classmates. No opportunity to share them. And when we're designing classes, we always assume that you have the book in front of you. So we're not looking for questions that have recall answers that you could quickly look up as you're taking the test. They're really things you have to think about and know the material with.
And no question. And I got that loud and strong. Now, some of the courses, which are you associated with major universities, or is this, quote-unquote, the university online? Are you associated with brick-and-mortar universities?
Usually, most programs are. There are some that are completely online. But, for instance, St. Leo University, we have a traditional campus. We've been here since the 1800s, just north of Tampa in Florida. And every class that we teach online is also taught on the ground. And all of the assessments are very similar. We have a standard syllabus that's used in every delivery method. So you're going to get the same college experience that you would have academically as if you were sitting in the classroom.
Oh, so in effect, once it's all said and done, once it is all said and done, the degree that you have will match up with any degree at any university anywhere in the country.
The St. Leo degree online is the same exact St. Leo degree on ground. Students who graduate online often come to campus to participate in graduation. They walk across the stage and they get the same exact degree as other students.
You know, an interesting point. Let's say that when we talk about the same degree as other students, there are students who maybe excel in a facet of the study, but there might be something that they just can't grasp. And let's talk tutoring for a moment. How does a student get tutoring if they need tutoring, and is that extra money?
Great question again. You always want to check that when you're looking at an evaluation for a university or a program. You want to make sure that the assistance that you're going to need is available when you need it. So a good question to ask, is the tutoring available and is it online? There are actually some schools that have online programs, but to take advantage of the tutoring, you would have to go to a campus. And that's not very helpful to many online students. So you want to check and see if online tutoring is available. We certainly offer online tutoring, and it's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that it fits with the student's time zone as well as their schedule. And that's what you want to look for. The same thing with technical assistance. If you're having a problem with your computer, you're having that problem right then and there. It might be 11 p.m. at night, but you still need assistance. So you want to make sure that you have assistance available to you 24/7.
One of the reasons I think the online school today has got to be one of the best things going, the kids are so high-tech today. They are everything is a BlackBerry, everything is an iPod, everything is, I don't even know what's out there. And they're so technological that it seems that the online courses would be perfect for a lot of them, getting away from, obviously, the social life of school. But it just seems that it would just fit right into their own particular agendas and be something that they would be very comfortable with.
It is very comfortable to younger students, and we do find students who gravitate to it for that reason. But I've recently completed a 3-year study that looks at the adult student, and what we found is that adult online students actually have higher levels of technology skill, have more computer use, and integrate the computer much more into their daily lives, and have a higher confidence level in their use of the computer than the traditional undergraduate student. So adults today also integrate technology all the time into their lives. They're using smartphones, they're using iPads, they're working and using multiple software programs. So I don't think it's really much of an age distinction that would prevent someone from looking at an online class.
Yeah, and now, by the way, in the things that are available get easier and easier. I'm an old dinosaur, and to get me to use a BlackBerry is like a big battle, but I'm finally using it, and I've got Fox News on last night, so I thought, okay, it's okay. I can use this thing, and I can get some value out of it. But I really believe in today's world, and especially with the advent of all of those side issues, or not side issues, but the side advantages of a computer, that you can get an education, you can get as educated as anybody from your own home.
You absolutely can. I totally agree. It's just the commitment to put that time in and the effort to really go after the degree that you're seeking and to make a difference in your life.
No, I think it's absolutely wonderful. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at, get more information, sign up if we want to?
Sure. If you're interested in seeing what an online class looks like, you can go to online.stleo, and it's stleo.edu. And there's a couple chat links there, or you can call one of the toll-free numbers, and someone will give you log information, go ahead and take a look. You know, it's a free sample class. You might as well take a look and see what it's like.
Wonderful. By the way, Susan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated it, and I think you guys are doing a really good thing because it just fits in today's world with the way of the world. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good night.
Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging you. Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you gon' get. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're for you. Whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange. Yesterday.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. Music that used to seem hollow. Now seems to
Kenneth Little Hawk with us is the co-author of Learning Little Hawk's Way of Storytelling. He's a Native American storyteller, a keynote speaker, an actor, and he's performed for over 3 million people. And let us say, Kenneth, hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Storytelling is an art. It's not just telling a story. There's so much more that goes beyond it. And let me ask you this. Is it Ken or Kenneth?
Kenneth.
Kenneth, okay. Kenneth, let me ask you this. Is storytelling inherent in you, or is this something that you learned as a child coming up from the culture that you were brought up in?
Both.
And what was it about the story that caused you to really get that spark inside of you to know that this is what you were meant to do, to tell how to tell?
One of the things was that my grandmother and grandfather taught the oral tradition through being very animated and also making a story as the old radio programs were. You could shut your eyes and listen to them, and you can imagine you were in that place that they were talking about.
Now, the dynamic of a story, let's start out this way. Tell a story. Let's get involved in it. Let's get the feel of what you're talking about with the story.
Okay. Grandfather took the young boy out for his first canoe ride. And the young boy, he's pushing the canoe toward the water, and grandfather said, "Hey, wait a minute, don't put the canoe in the water yet, okay?" The little boy said, "Okay, grandfather, I have to do something first." "What is it, grandfather?" "You watch and you learn." The grandfather took some tobacco out of his pouch and went to the edge of the bank and distributed water, a little tobacco into the water. And when he did, he began to sing. And after he was finished singing, he said a little prayer. And grandfather told the little boy, "This is what you have to do each time you put the canoe in the water." The little boy said, "Why, grandfather?" He said, "The water is what mother uses to wash clothes, to cook food. It's what we use to quench our thirst. It is what we use to travel on. It has our fish inside of it so we can have food to eat. Before we put the heavy canoe on the water, before we put our bodies in the canoe to rest on the water, we have to let the water know we respect it. We are not better than the water because we sit on it, because it is what we need in order to take us to see our relations and our friends who are far away downriver. It is also what we use to keep our life inside of us. No, we must respect the water, and we let it know before we get into it, on it. We must let it know that we respect and have compassion for all of life, and water is a part of all of life. Remember, respect and compassion for all of life is a part of why we are here."
That would extend to, and you just said compassion for all of life, and that's why we're here. That, Kenneth, would also extend to the neighbor that you have that lives across the way, the dog or cat that you have in your house. If we would touch a life like that and basically say, "Thank you for being here. I recognize you. I acknowledge your existence," our world would be a whole lot different today.
Grandfather said, "You cannot separate the Creator from creation."
No, absolutely. Now, let me ask you this. The flute music, you know, the world is built with vibration. When you use flute music with your storytelling, I felt your story. I could see it. I could feel it. I got the message. But when you add the flute, are you not adding something else? Are you not adding that something more that causes the mind, the body, and the emotion to join in on listening to the story and understanding?
Well, so often people don't understand that the voice has the vibration. And what comes from the voice has to come from the heart if it's going to touch people in a good way. An example is, what I'm holding here is a flute that I use to tell a little story and to teach a little story. It's about a minute long. I'll play it for you.
Please.
How would it be if we really cared for each other? That's the reason ancestors existed at all.
And are they really ancestors? And they're part of you. I don't think anybody truly dies, Kenneth, when it really comes down to it. When you were playing the flute, I had this. I was looking at four horsemen sitting on a hill, and somebody, a younger one, riding up in front of them, and they exchanged some words. And when they exchanged the words, the younger one went off, always knowing that the four would be with him, maybe not in body but in spirit, to go out and see the world. That's what I experienced when you were doing the flute.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah. Now, by the way, what was it that caused you to become the storyteller that you are?
More than one thing. One of the things is that my wife and I went up to Nova Scotia, where my grandmother is from, and on the way back, we noticed that there were less and less young people that were interested in the traditions that some of the older people were following. And my wife said, you know, you need to get closer to the elders and find out the stories and the history and other things so that it can be related to the people after they're not here any longer physically. And so that began a quest for me to go back to my elders and talk to them and then relate back to when I was a child, the things that I thought that I didn't recall that were as alive as I was. And it was very simple to go back, but it was difficult to be able to put all of it together so that it fit into storytelling.
Now, by the way, when you talk to people, now obviously everybody's going to get a little bit of a different image from the story, but what's that common bond? What's that common link that all of us have that you recognize that you touch when you tell a story?
Grandfather said, we're all one people called human beings. We just live on different parts of the land. And it's true. We're not different. No human being is different from any other human being. We might be unique as grass. One is a little taller, one is a little sharper at the point, one is more round, another one is wider, but it's all grass. We all know what pain is. We all know what sorrow is when we lose someone that we love. We also know what joy is. And we all hope that we would not be treated with prejudice or discrimination. Regardless of the language or the part of the world that we're from, we know all of these things individually and collectively. So there is no difference there. Uniqueness, but there is no difference. So if the story is told from the heart, to the heart, with that which means the same to all people, integrity, humility, honesty, unselfishness, compassion, all of these things everyone can relate to. Put those not only in your heart, but in the way you live, and you'll touch people.
But Kenneth, how today, and you know how diverse this world is today and the problems that we're having, how do you get this message across so everybody accepts it? Some people will hear you. They will. There's no question about that. But the most important people for you to touch are the people who normally wouldn't hear you. How do you get to them? That's not an easy question.
Well, in 1879, Chief Joseph was speaking to someone in the government, and they came to Chief Joseph, and they said, they didn't want any trouble. Chief Joseph said, there need be no trouble. Treat all men alike. Give them all the same law. Give them all an even chance to live and to grow. All men were made by the same great spirit, Chief. They are all brothers. The earth is the mother of all people, and all people should have equal rights upon it. And the gathering of the elders stood, and the audience was quieted because he was about to speak. And the elder said, how do we distinguish the hour of dawn when night ends and day began. Someone stood up and said, it is when at a distance and it is light enough out that you can tell the difference between a coyote and a wolf. Another said, it is when it is light enough out that at a distance you can tell the difference between a cedar and a pine. No to both was the answer of the elder. It is when you look into the face of a human being and have enough light inside of you to recognize him or her as brother or sister. Up until then, it is night, and we are still in darkness.
And to take it a step beyond that is to recognize them not only as brother or sister, to recognize them as yourself, because there is a connectedness for all humans. Sometimes we disconnect ourselves, sometimes we refuse to recognize it, but we are connected. It doesn't matter what the color is, what the gender is, what the it doesn't matter. And I think that's where people get confused, because we've learned over the years this thing called judgment. And I'm quite confident the elders would speak to that issue. Judgment. What would the elders say about that?
When you look into the face of others, make it a mirror unto yourself. Look at them first as human beings and not as what people have told you they are. If you come from a different country, generally that country is the name of where you come from and also the name of who you are. If you're from Britain, you're British. If you're from South America, you're South American. If you're from Ireland, you're Irish. From Italy, you're Italian. These are geographical locations, Grandfather said. That's who you are. But it's not important as what you are, a spiritual creation. And look at each other as that first, and then you'll be able to recognize yourself in the mirror.
Do you have children?
No.
Okay, if you had children, Kenneth, how would you teach the children and get it so deeply implanted in them that this was the way to be, as opposed to what they're exposed to in school and on television and the internet and all those things? These kids today, and the message that you have is critically important for these kids, but how do you get that message to them with all of those things that block the message?
Grandfather and grandmother started teaching as an infant. They taught the infant, and they just kept teaching them until they were able to crawl and then stand up and walk and then understood the words that they were saying. It's something that has to take place in the very beginning of life, not when you're 5 or 6 years old in the kindergarten, but it has to be something instilled in them as a part of their being, as a part of what they know inside themselves. There isn't anything that a child, especially a very young child, that you cannot see in their eyes what they have in their heart. They're innocent. They're open for all kinds of information. They want to be loved, and they show that they not only want to be loved, they show a lot of love. These things are more important than any of the technology that we have, because those were here long before the radio and long before the crystal set, long before telegraph. All these things were necessary before the technology came. We need to go back to the circle.
No question. Kenneth, we're just about running out of time. Is there a website we can find you at and buy the book and also find out what you're going to be doing, other projects?
The website is Findhorn, FINDHORN Press, BRESS.com, Amazon.com. The storytelling CDs are available at KennethLittleHawk.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time and the very powerful message that you have.
Michael, thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it, and we appreciate what you're doing. Keep it up.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Vicki Milazzo with us, and she is the author of The Wicked Success Revival Plan. 8 ways stressed out women can revive and renew mind, body, and soul. And we're going to say, Vicki, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Michael? Thank you.
Oh, I'm good. And thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about women today, I think that women, it's not to get something new, but it's to get something that got lost. I think everything that you're talking about brings out what's already there.
Absolutely. The book Wicked Success is Inside Every Woman. What I'm talking about is we already have everything inside of us. Now it's just a matter of reconnecting.
Now, by the way, when we talk about your institute, the Vicki Milazzo Institute Education Company, you founded it in 1982. What's the company about itself? What is the impetus of the company? What's the drive?
It's an education company. I'm a registered nurse. I'm also an attorney, so I blend it, nursing with the law, and I educate registered nurses on how to consult with attorneys and insurance companies on medical-related cases. So if you've ever wondered how those attorneys get so smart, it's because they have registered nurses behind the scenes working with them.
Love every second of that one. Okay. Now, when we really talk about women today, how do you get a woman to move beyond the challenges, the pain, the things when she's told you can't, you can't, you can't, you can't? How do you move beyond that? How do you get to that point where somebody really hears the message, sparks that fire within, and moves forward?
I think that question takes me back to when I started my business, because I started in 82, as you said, and nothing trained me to go out and start my own business. I was a registered nurse at the time. Nurses never even started businesses back then.
No.
But what I did is I actually looked to what I did as a registered nurse, all the things I was very successful at, and I thought, if I can do that, then I can do this future dream that I have for myself. So I think all women need to look at what they're currently are doing, what they have done in the past, look to those past successes to give you that confidence. Women can do anything we want, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. One of the your talking points, which is so critical, that if you want to thrive in a business, you've got to be able to basically thrive yourself. You've got to be able to cultivate the relationship that you have with yourself before you can do it with anyone else. And I think that holds true whether you're a man, you're a woman, whether you're a business, whatever the case may be. You can only give somebody what you have. You cannot give anybody what you don't have inside. And if you don't recognize it, you're never going to be able to offer it.
Yes, and when I started my business, I recognized that the same Vicky who got me into that position that I was in wasn't going to get me out of it. So it is about connecting with yourself, transforming yourself, and getting quiet. And I think today with the onslaught of the internet everywhere, email following us, texting, Facebooking, you name it, we really have to take that time to get connected.
Yeah, and there is a there's an image of women. I saw something very interesting this morning. Michelle Bachmann, who I happen to like, there was a picture of her, and then I was waking up and I was listening to the news, and there was somebody saying that this picture is sexist and this is this and that and whatever, and it's purely, they mentioned that word 5 or 6 times. And the picture in and of itself, she had a nasty look on her face because she looks like she's going to bite somebody. But that wasn't it. It was something political. It was somebody trying to say, look at her, she loses it and she can't control whatever. And it's what people see in it and make out of it. And I think that in and of itself is one of the biggest problems women and or men have today. Whatever you project doesn't mean everybody's going to see the same picture. So you got to kind of walk a very interesting tightrope.
Yeah, and that's an interesting comment that you're making, Michael, because I think one thing that women sometimes get too concerned with is how the rest of the world's going to perceive them. And sure. I think the most wickedly successful women, and by wicked I mean that exaggerated success, because wicked has another definition, which means sure. exaggerated. So women who have the most exaggerated, the most uncommon success, they cannot be worried about pleasing everybody. And successful women really get that. It doesn't mean you're trying to upset people, but at the same time, we have to be willing to take a stand and be okay with that, even if it does upset someone.
Sure. And when I hear the word wicked and wicked success as regard to women, let me tell you what I do here, which is okay to say, but it's not, this is a kick butt woman. Power.
You got it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a woman who has achieved in the most exaggerated, uncommon way.
Yeah,
we're all capable of it.
And there's no question. And the only person that holds you back is look in the mirror. Yourself.
Absolutely. And again, I knew when I wanted to start my own business that it was me who got myself in the unsatisfying situation that I found myself in. And only I could really get myself out of it.
You know, that's interesting because most people won't accept that. We live in a world today where we are trained, Vicky, to blame somebody else. It's your fault I'm doing this. It was my dad's fault I did this. It was my wife's fault, and on and on and on. And the time comes when we stop doing that and actually say, okay, you know, they did what they did, but I'm the one responsible for how I feel about it and the actions that I'm going to take.
Yeah, and I think what you're really focusing on is when we learn to live in the moment, then we understand we're responsible and accountable for that moment. And
yeah.
I know my grandmother, she had multiple sclerosis, and yet she was the happiest person that I knew. And I think too often we navigate, if we're not happy, we're not living our dream, we navigate toward people who are miserable. So it's also about learning to surround ourselves with the right energy, the right people, the right thoughts that control our own lives. That is how we get out of that rut, so to speak.
Yeah, let me give you my definition of a powerful woman. You ready for this?
Can't wait to hear it.
Okay. You walk up to her and you say, you're a real butthead. And she looks at you and says, yeah, and I'm good at it too. Next. You got it?
There might be a few people that would say I could qualify for that one. That's
no, but you hear what I'm saying? Is it, yeah, and I'm good at it. So what? You know, next,
yeah.
They're not affected.
Right.
They have it within themselves to know that's what you think, that's what you think. Okay, next, you know, the next subject, I don't have time for this. I think that's strength.
Yes, and nothing will drain your road to success faster than worrying and focusing on what everybody thinks.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key. And I think that's really the definition of a strong man or a strong woman. It's
I think, Michael, people who live big, they live large, they really are on to big things in their lives. They have less time for complaining. They have less time for gossip. They have less time for negativity. So they naturally navigate more toward positive energies that help them to achieve more success.
I think one of the things that they realize, Vicki, would get thrown into the mix basically is this, that, and you said it a moment ago, said it in a different way, you can't please everybody. So you please the people who you can please. The people who you can't please, doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to please them anyway. So go ahead and be the best you can be. At my optimum, Vicki, I could never be as good at being Vicki than Vicki can. And if I'm going to judge myself based on what your definition of perfection is, I got a problem here.
Yes, and that's what I want. I want women to know that they have those strengths already inside of them to be who they desire to be. I always tell the nurses who come through our programs, this is not a competition. You define what success means to you. For one person, it might be huge ambitions. For another, success might mean developing a career so that you can spend more time with your family. You get to define that.
No, absolutely. And I think that's really important when you say you get to define that, because who gives you permission, rhetorically, who gives you permission to define? You're the only one that can give you permission, and most people give it to somebody else. It's their responsibility to give me permission to be who I am. And we miss things. It's like if you're married, I'm not asking you if you are or not, but if you're married, you know, did you fall in love with your husband, or did you fall in love with the way your husband made you feel? And I think that's really what's critical. Most people take that surface that's hiding the real impetus of moving forward, and they gloss over it with what they think they see, and are frightened to death to take that other step to say, this is what really makes me tick. This is what causes me to move.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I am married, and I'm very blessed to have a husband who loves being married to a successful woman.
Oh, good. We'll keep him. He's a keeper.
21 years.
Oh, really? No, that's great, though. But that's actually, well, think about that. Did you fall in love with him, or did you fall in love with the way he made you feel?
Well, of course, it's the way that he made me feel.
Absolutely.
And that's why I've stayed married to him for 21 years. You've got it.
And what I really believe is the same thing. If you're going to be, quote unquote, a woman, and you're going to stand up to the world, you have to go underneath it and realize what it is that causes you to move forward. And then you also have to know what causes everybody else to move. What is that spark, that impetus that makes somebody take that step to do something, whatever it is? You get a handle on that, and all of a sudden, you can go out and be everything you want to be.
Yeah, and for many people, it is finding that spark. And for some women, it's just seizing the dissatisfaction and finally saying, okay, I am going to confront the dissatisfaction. And if that's what it takes to get you going, I say go for it.
No, absolutely. And there are people out there, Vicki, who failure is success. They've been taught that they can't do it. They've been taught somewhere, they've taken on this model that no matter what happens, there's going to be some unconscious sabotage there. And if they think they can't, they're going to draw people to them that will show them that they're proving themselves right about themselves. And no matter what you offer them, you take a program that you have to offer that can bring out the best in somebody, they're not going to see it.
Yeah, what I don't want for women is I don't want them to set that expectations level so low that they're just satisfied that they made it through the day. That's what I don't want for women.
Yeah. No, and no question. But it's touching. But those women who think that have a limited access to life. This is as high as they think they can get. So there's a satisfaction that happens. And once that satisfaction happens, there's very hard to push them through. They've got to be able to see through it to really get what's going on. And I think one of the ways to do it is this. You and your husband have the greatest relationship in the world. It is so good that everybody in the world should model after what you have. So you decide to write a book and go out in the talk circuit. So you're out there, and the first night you're on fire. You're just letting this audience know how great it is to be in love, how great it is to be in a relationship, how great it is to have someone there. And you guys walk out, and you look at each other, and you say, well, gee, not only did they not applaud you, but they looked at you like you were crazy, okay? Nobody told you that you would be speaking that first night to a group of battered women. They're not going to believe you. They're not going to believe that they can have that kind of a life. But the way you handle that is if you talk about other battered women who have gone through the same pain, the same challenges, and based on what you have, what you offer, that they saw the possibility of putting their foot on the path to having a decent life. And I think that in and of itself is the big challenge that I love everything you've got here. I'm looking at it. And I think the biggest challenge is saying to somebody, it's okay and you can do it too. But they've got to be able to do it, hear it in a way that it's a reachable, definable, manageable goal.
Well, again, each woman has to define, first of all, what it is they're striving for. But one of the things that every one of us can benefit from is looking to people who are already successful and how they got there. It's like a golfer doesn't learn to play golf from somebody who doesn't know how to play golf. You learn how to play golf from somebody who's already skilled. So if you have the desire, you always want to reach out to people who have already achieved that success.
Well, no question about it. And other people who have, or when I say you, I don't mean you, Vicky, but other people just like
sure.
you, that were having the problems that found that person and based on the way that they were taught became the golfer that they always wanted to be. It's got to be that, you know, I don't want to be repetitious, but it's got to be that something that's recognizable, something that's recognizable. And if I can mm-hmm. recognize it, then I can do it. But what if it's deep down in me and it's going to take somebody like you to look at it through different eyes to see what I don't see that causes the recognition? That's where the key is.
Well, you know, again, we have, as I said, such an onslaught of things coming at us today that it's just so easy to be disconnected. For most women, I think it starts with just waking up a few minutes early to have a little bit of quiet for your day. I always wake up for me, for nobody else. Always that's the start of my day. I look forward to it. I get connected with myself. I don't see how a woman or a man could possibly even know what they want out of their life when they are so bombarded by the noise that we all confront today. So
sure.
It starts with quiet. It starts with the ability to imagine. I always have like what I call a three-step process. First you have to imagine, then you have to believe, then you achieve. Imagine, believe, achieve. But it all starts with the ability to really imagine what it is you want.
Okay, and it's finding that goal and being able to recognize what you want. It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you don't know that you don't know. And then, again, it's looking through those eyes again to quote-unquote, bring the invisible up to the table. And everybody's
yes.
got it with them. Yeah, everybody's got, every woman out there has that ability. All she has to do is go to you, okay, the person who's been there, done that, take the steps and move, and with the ability to know that it can be done. Once that happens, the power happens.
And move away from people in your life that don't support you to grow. If you, for example, are always hanging with people who gossip and complain, then that's what your life will become. You will become that miserable person just like everybody else. And I noticed when I worked in the hospital that if I was not careful, I was going to be the victim of just hanging with people who weren't happy and all they did was complain about it. They didn't want to do anything. And that's one of the things that I really wanted for myself. I wanted to go for what I wanted. I didn't want to just sit around and complain about what I didn't have.
No question, and I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
WicketSuccess.com, and anyone interested can pre-order the book for a special offer at $12.97.
Wonderful. Vicky, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
You feel so lonely. You're gonna miss the hugging on you.
miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy, 'cause I wanna be, yeah. Said some of these days I'd do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely. For you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange. Yesterday's long gone forever. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. Music that used to seem hollow now seems to fit in your range. Today is the now and the never. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. It's fun to wander along a yesterday road.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Chris Dendy with us, nationally known expert on ADD, ADHD. She's got more than 40 years of experience as a teacher, school psychologist, mental health counselor, and an administrator. She's the author of three previous books about teens and ADHD. Her latest book is called Teaching Teens with ADD, ADHD, and Executive Deficits, a quick reference guide for teachers and parents. Chris, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm so glad to be with you tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much. And I'm glad you're here, too. You know, ADD, ADHD, with so many of the kids today, are there kids that don't have it that maybe have all of the symptoms, but it's really not bad? Do we run into that occasionally?
Yes, we do. In fact, you know, some people have been concerned that ADHD is overdiagnosed, but what we're really finding when I go out and visit the schools that there are a number of children who have it, but it's just not recognized, and they struggle and don't do well in school, and these children are often bright, and it's such a tragedy because it's such a waste of their potential.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe when you come down to it, it's something like we hear ADHD, ADD, the kid's got it, so give him a pill and put him in a closet someplace and it'll be over. Doesn't work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I'm very impressed with your insight because so many people think it's just a behavior problem. And if parents would just discipline their children, they would behave and do better in school. And what they don't realize is that there is a chemistry, a brain chemistry problem. This is a cognitive disorder, and that's why our children struggle so much in school. Probably as many as 90% of our children will struggle in school at some point. And this was certainly true. Our gifted, intellectually gifted son with an IQ of 140 struggled terribly in school, and I was really baffled. And the beginning of his freshman year, he was failing 4 of his 6 classes.
Sure. Now, by the way, when I was a kid, and we didn't know what ADHD was in those days, but I'm sure that I had it. On top of that, I was dyslexic, and I didn't find that out till I was 18 years old. So it was very interesting because I went through school with, you know, C's and D's. It wasn't that I didn't understand and grasp the material, but you sit me down at a desk and get me to do a test was like pulling teeth. And I did an interview about ADHD years ago, and what the guy said, which let me never forget this. He said, if we would have treated the kids differently, if we know the kid has got ADHD, don't sit him down at a desk, stand him up at a desk. And it's a completely different world. And I think you're absolutely correct that the strengths of that mind and how powerful these kids are, as long as you know and direct them in the proper fashion.
You've just given my comments for me. That's just such an excellent point. And I think what I find, ADHD runs in my family, so this is very personal. My youngest sister has it. She did terribly in school, later found her niche, became a chiropractor, and now she's teaching in high school, teaching chemistry and physics. It just took her a while to mature. One of the key pieces of research we found is that the ADHD brain matures 3 years later. And you were so fortunate to have found your strengths and your interests, and you pursue them. And what I have found is a lot of times people with ADHD actually have more fun in life because they're interesting and they do a lot of different things. And, you know, I had one PhD professor who said, I have 3 desks and 8 projects going on at all the time. My youngest sister has it, and she definitely has more fun than I do, so I'm envious.
No, by the way, I spent my entire life with, and I can appreciate that, I spent my entire life with, if something would come up, the flash in my head went, oh, I can do that, and the next thing I knew, I was one. And I think that, and I don't want to be talking about me, but the effect is that I think there's a tremendous amount of young minds that are wasted because they're not dealt with properly.
Well, one of the new discoveries that I found fascinating that explained why my child struggled is there's something that's called executive function, and that's like the brain CEO, the ability to be organized, to plan ahead, to get started on your work, to finish what you start. And many of our kids have this problem. It's like they can't coordinate to write an essay, to analyze, synthesize, paraphrase, summarize, and they have these great ideas, but they can't get them down on paper. And getting started is an executive skill, and unfortunately that's perceived by a lot of people as laziness, like you just didn't want to do your homework. And so my big passion now is to educate parents and teachers about these common learning problems and the importance of executive function deficit, and then give them the tools and the strategies to deal with them. And that's why we travel all over the country. And I think you saw that I've also been invited to speak in Saudi Arabia, where we had some extraordinary workshop sessions over there.
You know, it's interesting, too. You can go around the globe. The cultures may be different. The language may be different. But the common denominator is that we are all human beings and we have brains. And that brain is an electrochemical factory. And unless it's processing correctly and moving with the neurotransmitters, et cetera, moving that communication down the body to do what the body is supposed to do, you get many, many problems.
That's absolutely true. And one of the beauties of the way our brains work is that the executive skills and other skills that people with ADHD lack continue to mature into the 30s and 40s. And they also learn to compensate for some of their challenges. And so a lot of times we refer to these kids as late bloomers. So the important thing is to help them be successful in school. Don't let their self-esteem be damaged. Find their islands of competence, their things they're good at, so that they can feel good. and particularly with you, like with your radio skills and all, that has probably been a saving grace for you.
Well, absolutely, because, you know, I've done literally over 30,000 interviews in my career, and you can't imagine the information that I get every night, which is great for me. The gift I walk away with every night, you can't put a dollar value on. I'm like a walking encyclopedia. But it didn't come overnight. It came from a lot of years of making it fast and quick and whatever it is that causes the mind to work. So for me, I found my niche.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One other fascinating thing I learned personally, for me, school was always easy. I graduated second in my high school class, and when my son came along, I couldn't understand why he was struggling. And then I had an unusual experience. I had chemotherapy for breast cancer, but I'm fine now. But what I found is people with chemotherapy have chemo brain. And as I sat and tried to write my books, I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't get started. I couldn't organize my thoughts. And I looked out the window and I said, oh my, I have ADHD and problems with executive function. So for the first time in my life, I experienced what it was truly like for my son to have ADHD. And it's such a humbling experience.
Now, by the way, let me ask you this question. Had it not been for your son having ADHD, would you and I be talking tonight?
No, we would not.
No,
we would not.
Go ahead.
That has led my career. I've just been so passionate. How could this beautiful, talented, gifted son of mine struggle so much in school? And such a good heart and such a kind young man. And, you know, he looked at me in first grade and came home, and I asked him for his report card, and he says, he started crying, big tears, and he said, Mom, my teacher thinks I'm bad. First grade. I cried all the way home with him.
You know, but see, he was born with a legacy, and, you know, and thank goodness that you jumped on it and did what you did. The lives that could probably be saved and touched based on what happened to your son, you can't put a number on it. So in essence, it's too bad he had to go through what he had to go through, but what a gift he's given to everybody.
Well, and even he, you know, he has edited and filmed a new DVD that we did together that we featured 30 teenagers in who have ADHD. He co-authored a book with me, so it has helped him grow too, and he has shared. So this is really not just a job for us. This is a mission. This is a passion, and I get emails from people all over the country who are so desperate, and I feel so for them. And again, that's why I say I do so much traveling and training of teachers and referring people to my website, which is just my name, Chris, Chris Dendy, DENDY.com. And I have articles and information on there because we really, my husband and I both really want to help. My husband is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, and he thought discipline would fix everything. And then we have both been humbled, and so now he speaks to fathers to say, discipline isn't going to fix everything. You've got to teach these children. You've got to support their academics. You have to educate them about their ADHD. You have to make sure if they can handle the medication that they're on medication. And so we feel very blessed that we have learned all these lessons, and that's why I was so eager to share them, the 80-plus summaries that are in my new book.
Sure. And by the way, when it comes down to it, you said it all, it's a chemical problem. It's not a behavioral problem. And if it's not dealt with properly, there can be a disaster with those kids. You know, look at those kids that pull into themselves, that are not comfortable in social situations, that feel like they're failures because all of their friends are doing it and they can't do it. And it has nothing to do with their inability to learn. It's the way that they learn and the behavior that goes along with it. So it's just a learning process. And I really believe it sounds so simple, but it's a great fix.
Exactly. We know these kids, if you don't treat them and help them be successful, they're more likely to drop out of school. They're more likely to have brushes with the law. And it's and that just breaks my heart. We just have to intervene early with these children, educate our teachers, and help our children be successful.
No question about it. Now, are you getting any kind of challenge from the educational system? Is there anything that's stopping you from moving forward with everything that you have to offer?
Well, some schools are just open and embracing. I just returned from a school in Huntsville, Alabama this week. 2 weeks ago, the South Carolina Department of Education had me up there. The problem I'm running into in my own state is that they're doing evaluations that are invalid, and so they're saying, oh, this child is just lazy. It's not that he has ADHD. So my mission now is to meet with my local people and the state officials and say, here's the law, here's the educational and civil rights law. You need to understand that, and we've got to develop a better procedure for doing that. And I'm a person with my master's degree at Florida State University, was training to be an agent of change, and so I plan to meet with the top official in special education in Alabama to help him understand that there are multiple problems in this area across the state.
Well, let's take this to a different dimension. The programs that you're talking about, the testing that they're doing now that's not working, where does that come from? Where does that originate from?
Well, the procedures they set up are fine, but the problem is they're dated.
Let me lead you here. Hold on. Okay, but who is the they?
School psychologists will identify these tests as being indicative of ADHD. And so they say, we need to do these tests and decide if this child needs supports at school. But what they have failed to recognize in the last 10 years is that the issues of executive function have come up, what they call working memory, the getting started, the analyzing, problem-solving, synthesizing, and our children lack those skills, and so they're not assessing for those. And plus, we had one child they evaluated, and he's on medication, and so they said, well, he didn't score badly enough on this ADHD test, so he's not eligible. And I'm thinking, excuse me, when you're on medication, you're not going to have a bad score on an ADHD test. That's the whole purpose. That means the medicine is working. It doesn't mean that he's not eligible. And further, revisions to the Americans with Disabilities Law said that you can't say a child isn't eligible because medication is helping them. But that's a fairly new release, and I think some of the frontline people are not aware of that, but that's one of the things I'm going to make them aware of.
Chris, let me ask you this, and follow along with me. Let me probe for a minute here.
Okay.
The tests, where did they come from? Who originates them? Who is it that got paid to do the test? And is there dollars that are involved in keeping it rigidly the way it is? Is there money involved here?
Well, some of the brightest researchers in the country take the criteria of ADHD that they've observed in a group of people over time, and they say, okay, these are indicative of the characteristics. Now, that part of the test is not a problem. And where the problem comes in is that our knowledge about ADHD has changed, and the testing hasn't kept up with it.
Okay, do we lose you? I think we lost
Well,
you.
No, I'm still here. I think I'm hearing some kind of background or something. I was afraid I had lost you.
Oh, that's okay. It's the school board. They're doing their thing, so we can't talk. All right, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It's my name, Chris, chrisdendy.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
You know, it's been a real pleasure for me to meet you, Michael, and thanks for sharing your insights.
Oh, thank you so much, and take care. Good night.
Best wishes. Bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever. and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Dave Meyer with us. He's a nationally known author, a speaker, a trainer, and a mentor coach who believes that the only difference between obstacles and stepping stones are the way that they're used. He's the co-creator of VCI Learning Systems, LLC, and his recent book is The Engaged Manager, Make Your Team a Success, and They'll Make You a Success. Dave, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Oh, thank you. Are you a Dave or a David?
I go by Dave.
Yeah, oh, Dave is good.
Dave okay. is good.
Dave is good. Now, let me ask you this. A manager, you know, we talk about engaged manager. Define a manager, and let's work from there.
All right. Well, the manager is the person who is generally managing the processes and managing the people, if you will, to help them complete things on a regular basis. So at all levels of an organization, you have managers who are doing things, but there are more management skills used as you get closer to the front line.
Now, a manager, is this, Dave, something that's inherent in someone, or is this a learned skill? And I think it's a very important question, because just because somebody applies to be a manager doesn't necessarily mean that they have the wherewithal to do the job.
That's exactly true. And some folks are more natural than others. But all the skills of management and leadership, for that matter, can be learned if you realize that you miss some things and need to learn some things about management or leadership.
Okay, so when we're dealing with it, I think this is very important. The word now engaged comes into the conversation. A manager can be a great manager, but what if he's not engaged? What if he's not part and parcel of that team and works with that team?
Yeah, that's the purpose for this book, actually. This is actually the first in a series of books about employee engagement and organizational engagement. We start with the manager because they're the first line to the people who are doing the real work. And the next book is going to be the engaged leader, followed by the engaged organization, and then the engaged employee. And the engagement process here really refers to the concept of a manager getting people to work for him or her and do their very best, not because they're afraid of him or her, but because they want to, because they understand the value of working hard and enjoy it.
And I think it's critically important that everybody, quote-unquote, engaged is a great word. They've got to feel vested in whatever the project is. And all of a sudden, when they do that, the strength occurs. Let me give you a prime example. I have done consulting on and off most of my life. And there was a particular dental office that I had gone into to do consulting with. And they were at a certain level of income every month, and the dentist wanted to increase the level. So we had a meeting, an employee meeting, and I walked in and I looked at everybody and said, okay, today's the last day that anybody ever gets a raise here. And they looked at me and their mouths dropped open. And I said, what we're going to do is this. We're going to do a commission. And the way we're going to do a commission is this. Everybody starts referring. And as you refer people to come in, then the excess over and above what normally would be paid, you get a percentage of. And they got into it, and people started to refer people, and the dental office grew. They were engaged. They were part and parcel now of the business.
Yeah. They had bought into what you were trying to do. They saw the value in it from their own perspective, and they were anxious to contribute. And most people are that way.
Oh, sure. No question about it. I think it really is. And you said the key words. Most people are that way. They just don't know that they are. And I think good management skills allow people to recognize that within themselves.
Yeah, that's really true. And if you've been an employee in an organization and had a string of bad managers or old command and control style managers, you may sit there and say, why would I ever want to be engaged? Well, then you find an engaged manager, someone who's trying to work to bring people in, and it is such a different feeling, such an enjoyable feeling. You actually look forward to going to work. Look forward to make progress on things. You have more creativity. You have more ideas. And here's an important fact. Who do you want to talk to your customers? The employees who hate their boss or the employees who love their boss and their company?
Oh, no question. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
No question. And I think it drives you absolutely nuts if you walk into a market and you got these kids that are putting stuff up on the shelves, and then they're going to run back and meet you at the cash register. But while they're doing that, you ask a question, and you don't exist. It's like, you're bothering me. Can't you see that I'm busy? And the kid doesn't realize that I'm the one who's responsible for them getting a paycheck. They're not putting the two together, quote, unquote. They're not engaged. I think the next step is to engage the customer.
Exactly true. And engaged employees will engage the customers. And engaged customers are happy customers, and happy customers spend more money.
Yes.
It all ties together.
No question about it. You know what's amazing, though? As simple as the process you're talking about sounds, there's so many businesses that don't do that today. What do you think causes that?
Well, first of all, a lack of management training. It's just easier, you think, as a new manager, to yell at people and tell them what you want them to do, and then they'll just do it, right? The concept of getting them to work for you and engaging them is kind of an advanced technique that many managers, no matter how many years they've been managing, never pick up because they never get trained that this is the way to get people to do more. And if their bosses aren't engaged, they don't see the value. They don't see the difference.
You know, the work today in and of itself, Dave, it's a culture. And you're a certified behavioral consultant. Now, the key there is this. That being a certified behavioral consultant, we begin to realize that management is a behavior. Employee relation to management is a behavior. And when you really come down to it, it all comes down to behavior. And if I don't know how to act, I'm not going to give you what you want. And if I can't give you what you want, the bottom line at the end of the month is going to suffer.
That's right. And employees reflect the behavior of their management. So if the manager's disengaged, the manager doesn't really care, manager's just putting in time, so are the employees. The manager's engaged, he wants to do the right thing, or she wants to do the right thing. She talks to the people, she gets them excited about the goals of the organization. They get engaged. If they all tie together.
By the way, I'm going to be a manager for the moment. I pick up the book. What do I get out of it? How does it hold me by the hand to lead me through to the end result that I'm looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. As someone who learned on the job as a manager, I didn't want to write a book about theory of management. This is a very practical book with very practical examples of how to go about building your team and learning how to be an engaged manager. And the chapters actually build on each other to help you progress throughout the process of learning to become engaged. So once you realize there are things I can do better, and pick up the book, it'll walk you through the steps of how to become engaged yourself and how to engage your team. Not a lot of fluff, not a lot of theory, very practical advice, very practical stories that support that. So it really is designed as a tool to keep by your desk and say, oh, got a problem, better go look this up. And you can look it up in 5 minutes and know what to do.
Dave, where was it for you that the light bulb went on, all of a sudden that aha moment that management needed some managing? Where was it for you?
You know, that's a great question, because I was a manager for about 12 years and had been, quote, very successful when I ran into my first engaged manager. And quite frankly, I was so stunned by his behaviors that I thought, what's he trying to do here? But then I realized he was trying to help me and make me better. And, I mean, literally a big light bulb went on. I went, wow. And it makes me want to work harder. And if I want to work harder, are my employees going to want to work harder too? So I was a manager for 12 years before I realized this really key component of being successful.
Now, and by the way, success is a very interesting word. There are so many businesses today that they get into business, they've got a great product, you know, a certain amount of people buy them, then they hire more people to augment them their skills because they can't do it. There's where the problem lies, and there's where I think the window of opportunity for your book is right now. We're in, you know, a tremendous amount of people have been, businesses have downsized, so people have been let go, and we've outsourced, you know, that we don't, that can go on for hours, but they've outsourced, so people have gone home and become entrepreneurs. Some of the entrepreneurs are starting to make money doing what they're doing. But again, they're going beyond the point where they can do it themselves. They have to hire people. Now, hiring people doesn't necessarily mean that they know what to do once somebody gets hired. And so what I'm looking at here, whether you've got 3 people working for you or 1,003 working for you, the process is the same. The roadmap is the same.
Yeah, the process is the same. Roadmap's the same. But as you move up from a solopreneur to having 3 employees, having 5 employees, 50 to 100 to 1,000, et cetera, your skills have to change and adapt as well. You can't do it all yourself. And letting go and engaging your team and allowing them to do things that they can do better than you can do is how you really get success. If we're only tied to my talents and skills as an entrepreneur or as a manager, we're limited because I'm only so smart. If we engage all the employees in their brains, now we're a whole lot more likely to get a lot better results.
Oh, by the way, one of the things I learned a long time ago, many, many, many years ago, that if you're going to hire somebody, hire people who know more than you do.
Yeah, that is so hard for managers to do. They feel intimidated by it. They're afraid of it. They think, well, if I hire Susie here, she's so smart, she's going to make me look bad in the process. What they miss is that hiring Susie makes you look smart.
Good, yes.
Makes you look better.
Yes. I guess it's that one thing that it's called step away from the ego. You know, the focus, the job to get done is to get the most you can at the end of the month for what you do. And if everybody stays focused, you're in good shape and engaged. You know, we can use that word a million times during the interview. It's the same thing. If you're engaged, you're focused. And if you're focused, you make money.
That's right. And if we can engage all the employees and all their skills and all their talents, we're going to have a lot more chance of success than if we just engage the single person's talents or skills.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, you know what? When businesses decide to expand and to grow, usually they just say, okay, I see an opportunity here. We're going to make money over here. They do not look internally. And internally is going to either make or break them, especially in this world that we live in today. It's so highly competitive. And if we don't take care of what we have, we're going to be in major trouble.
Yep, that's really true. And the time to look at that is before you actually have the need. They say dig your well before you're thirsty. So before you need to promote managers from within, start investing in those people and getting them trained, help them develop the skills they have to have, so then when you need them, they can step in and be productive as opposed to stepping in and saying, well, now what do I do?
No question.
Well,
Dave, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at?
The website for the book is www.theengagedmanager.com. And that does tie back to the business website, which is ecilearning.com.
Wonderful. Dave Mayer, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.